Good afternoon. I am Krissa Hewitt, and this is Ears on Art, brought to you on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Last week, co-host Stephen DeLuque interviewed me, and this week, we change places. Even though we've been working together for a long time, it's interesting the things that you never quite start to talk about. So I learned some new things, and I think maybe he did too last week, and hope that you will learn something new about each of us. If you missed last week's program, you can get it on the KCBX webpage under Ears on Art Archives. As you will hear, Stephen is primarily a painter, but he explored some other disciplines as well along the way. That's what's been fun about getting to know a lot of artists over the years, is often how many different things that they decide they will explore in terms of either style or in terms of medium. And it may go as far as two-dimensional to three-dimensional or stay in one of those areas. It's just really exciting when you find a place that fits. Now it's time to find out how Stephen got his start. As promised last week, we're now reversing roles, and I will ask questions of co-host Stephen DeLuque.
And hopefully I'll be able to answer them with some semblance of intellect.
Well, of course. Don't be nervous. So you had asked me, in essence, the question that we often ask people, how this started for you. Some of mine was rattling off education, but how did you get involved in the arts?
I have always been artistic, even as a small child, which baffled my parents because nobody else in my family has ever expressed any interest in the arts whatsoever. But I started drawing at a very early age. My father was stationed in England from 1959 to 1961. I entered an All-British Isles art contest, and I won first prize for my age group, which, again, baffled my parents no end. As a matter of fact, I've just been going through my father's belongings, and there was a little certificate saying that I had won the first place. So it also had a 50-pound award that I never saw, so I'm curious about that.
And, of course, I'm sitting here going, oh, that's right, we're talking British money, and I'm imagining you carrying 50-pound something, which would have been hard to lose. So,
no, it was British pounds.
Right.
And then, like you, I was very fortunate to be in a school district where the arts were taught in elementary school through middle school and on in through into high school. So I had quite an arts education all throughout my childhood. However, when I got to Cal Poly, Cal Poly's art department was pitifully small, if I can put it that way.
Almost non-existent.
But I managed to take every art elective that I possibly could while getting a degree in the sciences. And I got to meet Erna Knapp and David Bodlack and some of the early instructors in the art department here at Cal Poly. And one of the people I also met was Joanne Ruggles, who was teaching the printmaking courses at that time. And we became very good friends. And that is actually how Chris and I met, was that I was taking an evening figure drawing class from Joanne, and Chris had an evening, I think it was a jewelry class.
Yeah, the metalsmithing, which was the hammering class I had to teach at night. Nobody would have tolerated that amount of noise. So, yes, we were all there and going, it feels just more comfortable to all walk out to the parking lot together. So,
and so that's how we started. And then one day, Chris approached me and said, would you be interested in co-hosting a radio program? And I've always been one who believes that you should never say no to a new experience. It's like, even if you don't like it, you can always quit, but at least experience it first. And here it is 13 years later.
Oh, no, no, no. Even, well, for you, probably more like 16.
No, could be.
16, 17, something like that.
And we're still here.
Absolutely. So, and again, you've done the printmaking, mm-hmm. but you haven't been doing that as much, perhaps because of facility lack, or did you just find that that wasn't quite as much a pleasure, is painting or drawing?
It was not only facility, but I also did not like dealing with a lot of very toxic chemicals. And I decided that, you know, immersing my hands in acetone probably wasn't the brightest thing in the world to do. So I slowly phased that out, and I started picking up more drawing and painting and things like that. Although in college, most of what I did was sculpture. So,
okay, so elaborate on that for me. What kind of materials were you working with and doing what?
Well, I did take a ceramics course from Henry Wessels. And I also had orientation to materials and those types of courses, which we had like found object construction and things like that. I got heavily into soft sculpture for a while. I learned how to sew pretty damn well. But a lot of those things started falling to the wayside once my career started taking off. I was in the food service industry for years. And then, of course, I founded a wholesale bakery and then Utopia Bakery. And that just took over my life. I had no time for anything else during that period.
So by coming to Joanne's evening classes, that allowed you to kind of
that was my artistic outpouring right there, all 3 hours of it, twice a week.
And it was during some of that initial period, as you and I were getting to know each other, that was also a stage when you were doing some pretty intense political statements and other kinds of work. Has that continued? Where does that fit in the scheme of things?
I went through a very, very intense period of doing highly political artwork. Matter of fact, my very first show at Linnaeus, which was in 2001, I believe it was, was extremely controversial, and there was a lot of letter writing back and forth types of things. I got 3 death threats from one of the paintings, which was like, you know, as an artist, you want a reaction, and that's a reaction. But I haven't continued as much political work lately as I did during like 2001 through 2010.
And how would you describe your style that's developed?
I do acrylic painting on large canvases, and they're assembled. I rarely do any imagery on a single canvas. I tend to like collect canvases together, and so the image just kind of spreads over all of them. Or when I did my non-objective work, I actually assembled a sculptural kind of canvas construction and painted those.
So the canvas exterior outer edge is not usually a rectangle anymore?
No, they're pretty much free form after a while.
Once again, I think it's fun to give a definition of a word that maybe we haven't talked about all that often. In this case, you're talking about non-objective. We use that term a little differently than abstraction, in that non-objective is really about not trying to be recognizable from any particular imagery or object. And then in this case, you've taken it one step farther with creating canvases themselves that are not a predictable rectangle or square. A rectangle here, a square there, and they all get attached. So it works.
And at weird angles and constructions and yeah.
When you're working fairly large, I mean, we're not talking 20-inch by 24-inch canvases, mm-hmm. and especially by the time you assemble several things, we're talking feet mm-hmm. often, right? How do you kind of gain a perspective? I mean, are you putting it on a wall with a really long stick and standing back? Or, you know, how do you gain a sense of this is what it needs to look like?
I did one painting. It started out on paper, and actually it started in one of Joanne's painting classes called The Orthodoxy of Pity. And I just kept gluing paper together as the image wanted to expand, and it became so big, I think it's about 12 and a half by 16 feet, that the only way that I could get perspective was I would lay it in the driveway of my friend's house and climb up on their second story balcony and look over and go like, oh no, that has to be changed. That's not working at all. And that's how I did those large pieces. And I also did a self-portrait that is 5 by 8 feet. And I will never do that again. I got so tired of climbing up and down stools and ladders and everything and doing the painting. That was miserable.
Yeah, we all have our crosses to bear, whether it's weight or dangerous materials or you know, sometimes just pure size, you know, one way or another. So it's interesting. And also, you haven't had the privilege of having just a huge studio where you could put something out on a wall for 20 feet.
No.
Not many people have that, but...
No, I didn't. I was using about one half of my tiny little one-car garage. Well, I remember Joanne, because she paints on large canvases as well, and she had a canvas constructed that she could rotate the canvases so she didn't have to get up on stools. I thought that was genius.
Yeah. I mean, we figure out things to do. How much do you find yourself looking at other work or talking with other people to keep you stimulated, or is it better to just kind of stay in your own world more or less?
I find a lot of varying artworks very stimulating. I remember I had never been a huge fan of non-objective artwork. And then one year when we were at the jewelry show in Las Vegas, we went to the Bellagio. And Steve Wynn had a gallery in there that was exhibiting part of his personal collection. And the very first painting I saw when I walked in was a Pollock. And it mesmerized me. I think I stood in front of that painting for an hour staring at it. And I shocked myself because I had never really looked at non-objective work before, and this was just an absolutely stunning painting. And that was my first foray into looking at other styles, because I had always been very representational in my painting. And so that allowed me the freedom to start exploring with other types of styles.
Of course, it was also always very easy with Jackson Pollock to be labeling him as somebody who either didn't know how to paint or just was dribbling and splashing and whatever, and that there was no sense of his control over anything. And I think, like you, I got to a place where I kind of went, I don't think that that's the whole picture.
No, they are so deep and rich. It's amazing. You see so much when you start looking at them closely and analyzing them. They're incredibly intricate paintings.
And that goes to a topic that we have often discussed with guests, is knowing when to stop on a work.
Yeah, that's a toughie. I used to have an instructor at one point. He says, don't show them any more than they can see. And I kind of understand that. I mean, you can go into, you know, the three-hair brush, you know, type of thing and do these incredibly intricate, realistic paintings. But if nobody's going to appreciate that kind of level, then why would you do that? So for me, it's kind of like Jerome Witkin, and he gets into these broad brush strokes that are just beautiful expressions. And yet from a distance, it looks like he has done this photographic analysis of this particular type of subject matter.
Yeah, I find it interesting often when I'm standing back from something and then I come up close and I go, oh, this really is a painting. And I have some of that with Bob Reynolds, local artist, and his watercolor. And I've always said that he does water better than anybody I've known. But it's amazing if I get up within inches of the piece, some of that disappears in terms of the beauty of that sense. And I go, okay, back up.
Yeah, they're very expressive, and you don't, and from a distance, you really can't see that. But once you get up close and you can see the brush strokes and those types of things, it's amazing what people can portray.
Right. And at the same time, sometimes those brush strokes then get in the way of your imagery of this beautiful lake surface or something. So it's that contrast of, you know, when you're working a foot away that you need to do A, B, and C to somehow translate it as something that will look quite different from 5 feet away.
Right.
Metal doesn't quite do that.
But some sculpture does. I mean, I find that very, very interesting in the fact that it looks far different close up than it does far away. And I think Bruce Beasley's work certainly attests to that.
Yeah, and it's...
And the patinas he would get on the surfaces were just gorgeous.
Just a whole lot of different things to consider all the time. So here's a question I don't think we've asked too many people. How do you think defining yourself or being an artist actually affects who you are as a whole person?
That's an interesting question. I have always considered myself to be artistic, if not necessarily a true practicing artist. To me, artwork and how I express myself through my artwork is just another fundamental level of communication. It's a way that I can communicate thoughts and ideas and processes that I can't do in any other medium. It is a part of my voice, really. It's a part of my being.
Does it have an impact on other parts of your life when you're not painting? How you think about things or see the world?
I think the creative process is pervasive. I don't think you can separate yourself from that if you are an artist, because you look through everything in an analytical way. And we've mentioned this so many times before about problem solving, and that's exactly what creativity is all about, is problem solving, finding a way to express to your audience what it is you wish to say.
I have certainly found sometimes that I'll hear others complain that they haven't been in their studio lately and that all is not right with the world. And I'm going, I haven't been in my studio in a long time, perhaps, and then think, oh, does that mean that I'm not an artist? But I've really discovered that I, as you say, I'm doing that problem solving. I'm doing that thinking in so many different ways. When I retired and was building an addition on my studio, it was just a daily question and answer period.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely correct. And we both enjoy cooking. And cooking also is an incredibly creative process and also involves problem solving. And yet I'm not one of those artists who thinks that I have to go to my studio every single day or I'm not reaching my full potential. I tend to paint in streaks. I'll get a series of ideas in my head, and I will paint continuously for 2 or 3 weeks to the point of exhaustion. But then I'll stop. I mean, sometimes I just hit the end of the series, and it's time for me to rethink about what it is I want to do next.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And again, sometimes when I have gone through a streak of something and then I make the mistake of cleaning up, and then it seems very hard to get the studio to say, oh, work in here again. Make a mess.
I try to leave my studio a little messy all the time so that you don't feel like you're desecrating something when you start creating again.
Exactly. Well, I think that helps sum it up. It just really, I've given a lot of thought, and it really does seem to me that it is a mindset after a while, that it's not just an extra part of our life that I'm working with metal or that you're painting or whatever it is we're doing. It's part of a big whole.
It's part of who we are. I mean, it's really a big part of our personality.
Thank you so much for cluing us in, and see where we go next.
It's always an adventure.
Between last week with me and this week with you, got a little different sense of, or an expanded sense of who we are. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much, Krissa, and thank you all out there for listening.
If you did not catch last week's show, you can go to the KCBX webpage and search under Ears on Art Archives, where you can find that show and several others. In December, we are excited once again to be bringing you our storytelling feature, where community members share stories about a theme that we have given them. This has been part of our tradition since the first year that we were on air, thanks to the wonderful suggestion of Bill Beeson. I must admit, it's hard to ever get to December without thinking of the special stories that he would share with us. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio, with featured guest today, co-host Stephen DeLuque. I am Krissa Hewitt, and on behalf of Stephen DeLuque, as always, want to thank you so much for listening. Want to wish you a very happy Thanksgiving and look forward to joining up with you next month for Storytelling Part 1 and Part 2.